The climate is changing. So are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, March 31st on CBC Radio. The carbon tax rises tomorrow, and along with it, so does the backlash. First up, the power and peril of this Canadian climate policy. After that, he was racially profiled by police as a teen, so Keith Merrith decided to join their ranks. The retired Canadian superintendent will share his inside take on how to reform law enforcement. And then, as NATO turns 75, we'll size up our role in the military alliance amid calls for Canada to bulk up defense spending. And later, Hala Gurani has traveled the world to report on conflict and displacement, and she'll be by to share her quest for belonging as someone whose life and work span the globe. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. Probably heard a lot of talk around the federal carbon tax lately, as it is set to rise tomorrow. The federal climate action policy brought in by the governing Liberals in 2019 was designed to encourage people to reduce their carbon emissions by adding an additional tax to fossil fuel products. And ever since, there has been a lot of confusion and conjecture around this policy's effectiveness and how it actually works. Adam Radwanski is the climate policy columnist for the Globe and Mail, and Stephanie Taylor is a parliamentary reporter for the Canadian Press. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Adam, let's just back up the bus, if you will, for a moment. Start with some basics, some carbon tax 101. In a nutshell, what is carbon pricing and how does it apply here in Canada?
So carbon pricing just is what it sounds like. It is a price on, well, the government would say a price on pollution, a price on fossil fuels, essentially, that we consume. And there are actually two different versions of it in Canada. There's the one that most of us pay on things like gasoline or natural gas for home heating, called the fuel charge. And then there's a second system that applies to heavy industrial emitters that is mostly applied by the provinces but has to meet federal criteria. In the case of the one that most of us pay, the federal government in most cases is the one that applies it, except in Quebec and British Columbia, where the provincial government has their own policy.
Yeah, and in the territories as well, three territories.
That's right.
So when the Prime Minister back in, I guess, 2017, 2018, Stephanie, was thinking, hey, we need to put a price, as Adam says, they call it a price on pollution. Why did they want to bring that in? What was their thinking?
This was a policy that's supported by many economists, first and foremost. This is the argument for carbon pricing is that it's going to be the most low-cost measure to affect climate change. And climate change, politically, why they want to bring this in, the Prime Minister believes that Canada needs to do more to fight climate change. And they are making an argument that we all have a role to play. As Adam says, there's industrial emitters, but there's also individuals who wanted to see more climate action and fight this policy in a way that maybe necessarily hadn't been seen to many young people and progressives and supporters under the previous Conservative government. So climate change and fighting climate change was and is a hallmark of the Liberal government. This is something the Prime Minister wants to see as part of his legacy and a part of the legacy from this government going forward, however long it lasts. But the mechanism to do it was supported quite heavily by economists, as we even saw this week in a recent open letter that came to the defense of this is just, in their view, the smartest way to actually be achieving reducing greenhouse gas emissions and pollution in this country.
So, Adam, we'll talk more about the politics of all of this in just a bit. But if we go back to like 2018, 2019, when this is brought in, so the Liberals are on side. Where are the Conservatives on this? Did they like the idea of carbon pricing back then?
No, and that's kind of the irony of the policy, is that it was always pitched as a kind of conservative-friendly version of fighting climate change, you know, because it is market-based. Because in theory, you know, it reduces the need for government to spend, provide subsidies, etc. In practice, they've opposed it dating back, actually, if you go back to the politics of this in Canada. It was first pitched by the Liberals back in 2008 when Stéphane Dion was a Liberal leader and ran on a carbon tax, and Stephen Harper ran against it. And it kind of became orthodoxy for Conservatives to oppose it and claim it was just a tax grab. That pretty much carried through, with the one notable exception that in the last federal election in 2021, the Conservatives had, you know, kind of come around to it, under Aaron O'Toole. They weren't completely supportive, but for the first time, they were open to at least a version of carbon pricing. But then following that election, they went back against it again. So for the most part, they've opposed it, with that one blip, which they seem to have decided was, in fact, just that, just a brief experiment that they're not returning to.
Okay, Adam, let me stick with you. The other key part of this policy is the rebate. So aside from BC, Quebec, or the three territories, if you file a tax return, you get payments four times a year. It shows up on your bank statement as something like the Federal Climate Action Incentive, in case people are wondering what that is. That's what it is. If we do the math here, how much does this actually cost them, the average person, over the course of a year?
Well, most people come out ahead. I mean, this is the government's big pitch, and it's true. Now, the rebate that you get really varies depending what province you're in, but that's based on basically how much carbon tax you have to pay there. So it's contingent on fossil fuel use in each place. But, you know, in Ontario, for instance, you know, the annual rebate for a family of four is about $1,100, a little bit over that in the coming year. You know, for most people, that's probably more than you're going to spend cumulatively on the carbon tax on gas and home heating, et cetera. But not quite everybody. The idea is that only the people who use the most will wind up coming up behind. And for the most part, that'll be relatively affluent people who can afford it because they might have big houses, you know, gas-guzzling cars, et cetera. The catch for the government has been that, first of all, not everybody believes that they're coming out ahead. In fact, I think most people don't, even though they may be. And then there are people, for instance, you know, if you have long commutes, if you live in rural areas, there are people who don't come out ahead, who maybe have trouble affording it. So it does work well for most people, but that's not the perception. And perhaps the discussion is driven a little bit by those who don't come out ahead from it.
Okay, so let's just stick with this, the kind of rebate part, Adam, because the Prime Minister, who's been vigorously defending this over the past number of weeks, said a couple of days ago, as you called it, the majority, he said 8 out of 10 families make more money with the Canada carbon rebate than it costs with the price on pollution. Okay, what is the thinking, though, behind charging this tax only to reimburse it in full plus? Like, why would you do that?
Yeah, the key thing to understand here is that you don't get back an amount that is any way tied to how much you personally consume that year. So it's not like you spend $5 on carbon tax when you gas up one time, and then that's coming back to you later in the year. It is only tied to where you live. So the idea is that it rewards people who consume less fossil fuel, and it punishes those who consume more, and that it incentivizes you. For instance, if your home runs on natural gas, you're paying more. Perhaps you're roughly getting back the same amount you spent that year on the carbon price. If you then put in a heat pump in your home, then you were consuming less fossil fuel, you're paying less carbon tax, and ultimately you come out probably a few hundred dollars ahead. So basically it's that tie of the less that you consume, the further out ahead you come.
Okay. So that's sort of the policy and the pricing. Let's bring in the politics in all of this. Stephanie, there's been a lot of blowback to the carbon tax, especially ahead of tomorrow's hike. The leader of the official opposition, Pierre Poilievre, has constantly been using it as a weapon against Justin Trudeau and the Liberal Party. Axe the tax is a slogan. There have been axe the tax rallies. First, can you just break down Poilievre's argument about why the carbon tax is a bad idea? As Adam said, there was a little reprieve, and depending on who the conservative leader was, that they might have been more open to carbon pricing. But Poilievre is like, this is a bad idea. Why does he say that?
What Mr. Poilievre has done is what the conservatives have wanted to try to do really since this policy's inception, which is they wanted Canadians to see this as an affordability issue. They don't want Canadians to think of carbon pricing as a climate change policy. Erin O'Toole in 2021 brought in a conservative carbon price, but that was following the 2019 election where the party saw that it lost seats and that Canadians weren't buying what it was selling when it came out in opposition to carbon price without really a believable plan of its own. The Conservatives tried to remedy that in 2021. It didn't work. But what Mr. Poilievre is really trying to do is something the Conservatives have wanted to do for a long time. And he is almost at the perfect timing to be able to make this argument because Canadians are in an affordability crisis. We are talking all the time about how Canadians feel like they can't make their mortgage payments, how their wages aren't going up fast enough, how the food has gone up at the grocery store. So his point is an old one, but at a new time where the context and the economic times we're living in has kind of emboldened this message where he's able to sell this and is selling it in a way that the carbon price is adding a financial burden to people's lives at a time when they're already paying more. And he's not talking about this as a climate change policy, which it has been ushered in as.
So you've been, Stephanie, attending some of these conservative leaders' rallies, the quote-unquote axe the tax rallies. You've interviewed his supporters about the carbon tax. So when you talk to them, what are they hearing from Pierre Poilievre's calls to axe the tax?
They're hearing a rallying cry that speaks to how they feel their lives are too expensive. This is all feelings-based. Axe the tax to Mr. Poilievre's supporters, whether it is, staunchly conservative supporters who the parties would have had their votes for regardless, or whether it's new audiences and the way that he's kind of growing this younger and different coalition, is that they see this as a rallying cry to the economic grievances they have. So one woman I spoke to, 41-year-old stay-at-home mother of two, says she's using a food bank, and she sees this as a slogan about economic freedom and talking about the cost of living pressures she faces. There was another woman we spoke to who saw axe the tax referring to her income tax payments, and it's more this idea of the tax system writ large. So the tenor of the debate, this is where the Liberals and other proponents of carbon pricing are really getting frustrated, because the debate that's happening and what Mr. Poilievre and other supporters of wanting to get rid of this are talking about is not necessarily rooted in policy, what this actually is and how it works and rebates and then the system Adam has outlined. But it is really this feeling of life is unaffordable right now, and this is a symbol of that and a rallying cry around this.
If you're just joining us, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Globe and Mail's climate policy columnist Adam Radwanski and parliamentary reporter for the Canadian Press, Stephanie Taylor. We're talking about the carbon tax, which is set to go up tomorrow. Okay, Adam, so as Stephanie said, the Liberals are frustrated that they can't seem to get their message across. So why is this, let me ask it this way, is this policy actually difficult to explain, or is this a failure on the part of the Liberals to actually explain it well?
I think it is difficult to explain. I mean, look, you've had me kind of lay out off the top here, right? How does this work? Wait, so if we're getting all the money back, what does it do? It's not terribly intuitive. It's confusing. We've heard a lot of blame. I mean, as Stephanie mentioned, the economists love this policy. They pushed it for a long time. A lot of the same people who initially advocated it have since said, well, you know, the government's just not communicating it well. I think there's an element of truth to that. I think something like the rebates, for instance, early on, which we got once a year when we filed our taxes, it was really unclear how you were getting them. I think that was a failing, that they didn't make the rebates very clear. They've since made them a lot clearer. Like, you now do get them quarterly. They draw attention to it. People still are having trouble understanding it. And it still isn't, it's gotten, if anything, more unpopular. So I don't think there are easy communication fixes. I think fundamentally the problem you've got here is this is a quite complicated policy with complicated goals. It's sort of a high-minded sort of approach. You have to explain it pretty carefully. But it's a very easy policy to oppose. It's very easy to just say, look, do you really believe the government is giving you all this money back? It's a tax grab. And especially at a time when trust in the government is fairly low, you know, you've got a government that's fairly late in its lifespan right now, it's quite easy to demonize them on it. Now, to be very clear, it does not have a huge impact on inflation. Like it's a, you know, the Bank of Canada put out information on this. I mean, it's a fraction of a percentage point in terms of its impact on inflation. But perception wise, it's very easy to blame it. And if you try to push back on that, I think it's much more difficult.
Hmm. And Stephanie, when you were talking to the two Polyev supporters out there and you say, hey, okay, if it's not the carbon tax that you're behind, what are the alternatives? What are they suggesting to you? What is the leader of the official opposition suggesting as an alternative to this?
Mr. Polyev has not laid out his climate plan, and this is something the Liberals and other critics will attack him over, but we are not in an election campaign yet, right? So what Mr. Polyev has talked about is investing in technology. Interestingly enough, he has been unclear about what his intention would be when it comes to the industrial carbon price, so the one that is applied to heavy emitters that does have a lot more buy-in from premiers, specifically even conservative ones, although, you know, he hasn't necessarily answered what he would do about the federal backstop, is whether he would take it away, whether he'd keep it. And he talks about technologies like carbon capture and storage. But I mean, this is the central concern the Liberals and other proponents of carbon pricing have with the point he's making, is that, to Adam's point, axe the tax is a very easy slogan to be selling to people at a time when affordability anxieties and fears are at a fever pitch, as the environment minister wrote in a recent op-ed. But fleshing out what the conservative leader might do if the conservatives form the next government, I mean, Mr. Polyev is a very big proponent of the oil and gas industry. He's a guy who grew up in Western Canada from Alberta. So he's talked not favorably about keeping anything away, but the oil and gas emissions cap is on. But we don't know the details of this yet. But this is the frustration I think the Liberals are facing, is that they're up against this, feels like a tidal wave of you know, Mr. Polyev's very aggressive communication strategy, that of other conservative premiers that are complaining to high heavens about this policy and what it's doing to everyday consumers, but not really fleshing out the bigger policy debate about, you know, how are you going to cut down emissions, and what about this new report from the Climate Institute that said, although it's the industrial carbon price that's doing a lot of the heavy lifting, there is still a little bit of an impact that's coming from the consumer one.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, the provincial level, there's a lot of pushback. Many, many premiers, and the majority of them now, want tomorrow's hike canceled. And we saw Alberta's premier, as well as Saskatchewan and New Brunswick, some testifying at a parliamentary committee this past week about the carbon tax. At the time, Danielle Smith, Alberta's premier, called it inhumane. But we've also seen now, like, Manitoba's NDP premier joining his provincial counterparts and saying he opposes it too. The prime minister has been accusing conservative premiers of, quote, lying to Canadians about the carbon tax. And he said, look, you don't want this thing. Give me some alternatives. Why are the premiers sort of galvanizing? Because it is more than just conservative premiers now, and we're seeing other politicians at the municipal levels as well saying, no, thank you. Steph?
I think because affordability is just so top of mind right now, and the Liberals and proponents of this cannot get away from the fact that this does have an upfront cost, albeit a very small one to anything like inflation, but there is, come Monday, still going to be a 3.3% increase when it comes to this on the carbon price on a liter of gasoline. I also think that we're seeing premiers that have their own domestic matters at hand. For Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe, this is an election year for him. For Blaine Higgs, this is the same type of thing. NDP Manitoba Premier Wab Kanew is going to be coming out with his first budget soon, and he, in that province, is having to make sure that he is seen as kind of that middle Manitoban political sentiment of not someone who looks like he's a big favor of kind of tax and spend. So there's also domestic politics at play here, on top of what's going on at the national scale when it comes to what Mr. Polyev is trying to do, as well as, you know, the lot that the federal Liberals find themselves in. But a lot of these premiers, Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe, Blaine Higgs, is also talking about, you know, what Mr. Polyev is talking about, in that Canada, in their argument, is a small player on the world stage when it comes to emissions. You should be focusing more on supporting our natural resource development, shipping that overseas to help other countries become less dependent. And as Scott Moe said this week, he doesn't necessarily think that industries in Saskatchewan should be paying for a price on solution, but just working on ways to kind of reduce the intensity of them. So these are tried and true political fights that have been playing out in these provinces for a long time that are just kind of being very emboldened and punctuated right now.
And so, Adam, as I said at the beginning, as you laid out, this was brought in 2019 to bring down our carbon emissions. Canada has a goal to reduce total carbon emissions between 40 and 45% by the year 2030. So we have time to go. But has the carbon tax been an effective policy in bringing down those emissions and changing people's behaviors when it comes to fossil fuel consumption?
It has been somewhat, but, you know, this has been hard to measure, of course, because and how do you know exactly what prompts behavioral changes? But Stephanie mentioned the Climate Institute report that came out a couple weeks ago. So it found that out of all the emissions reductions that we're on pace for by 2030, which are significant, they're not quite going to get us to 40% reduction overall, but per this modeling, they've got us on a decent pace. Probably over 30% reduction from 2005 levels. It found that the fuel charge, the one that most of us pay, the one on your gas and on your home heating and so on, would be responsible for between 8 and 14% of all those reductions. That's not nothing, but it's also a lot less than a few other policies, including the one that industry pays. Stephanie mentioned that you know, the industrial one is more effective. In fact, that one was found to be responsible for between up to 48%, between 20 and 48% of all emissions reductions. It's also even less effective than something like stricter methane regulations for the oil and gas sector. So it does matter. It has been somewhat effective, but it's not the be-all and end-all of Canadian climate policy that it's been presented as in some cases. And in fact, probably has had way too big a place in our debate relative to what it does. And I think what you're going to start to see, and even that report reflected this a bit, I think you're going to see people who care deeply about climate policy, climate activists and think tanks and some economists perhaps even, start to shift their focus more toward how do we save some of the other policies if there's a change in government federally. And that would include the industrial price, which it's true that that Mr. Poilievre hasn't indicated yet what he would do with that, which means there's at least a chance of it staying. I think there's some recognition among advocates for climate policy that the carbon price we all know best probably has a not great future, because whenever there is a change in government, it probably doesn't survive. So how do we start downplaying this a bit, and how do we shift our focus to stuff that actually can be saved? And kind of a recognition, I don't want to say this is a loser of an issue of a policy politically, but I would say, I guess, that it may have been more trouble than it's worth relative to the impact.
And Steph, do you agree with that? Like, the future of this probably has a shorter shelf life, the policy, than the Liberals may have wanted.
I wouldn't have said that a few months ago, but when we saw the Prime Minister introduce a carve out for home heating because of the concerns he was hearing from his caucus in Atlantic Canada, I really do think that shifted the political landscape of this, because that was really the first time you saw the Liberals admit what their critics like the Conservatives have been saying, and what they'd been saying up until that point was just markedly not true, is that this did not have an affordability impact, that they were resolute and that their rebates were able to be more generous to low-income households, that the rebates is what helped offset the cost of this. And I think that moment where the Prime Minister came in and announced this, you know, just hours before Mr. Poilievre was going to take to the stage last fall for one of his Axe the Tax rallies, I think really got people a bit worried, and was this kind of moment of almost, whoa, this is a policy that the Liberal government has been fighting. And I think it was a fight that they thought they won. I think this was a fight that when the Supreme Court ruled that it was constitutionally able to do this, politically, the Prime Minister has referenced that they fought and won the 2019 election when Andrew Scheer, then Conservative leader, tried to make this an issue, didn't work in their favor. They fought and won in 2021, and the Prime Minister has indicated that he's willing to do that again. But Mr. Poilievre is willing to make and says he's going to make this a carbon tax election. And I think if we're going into the next election thinking about affordability, this issue is affordability, and not thinking about the consumer carbon price in terms of its benefits to climate change, that's a different landscape than the Liberals have fought this on in the past.
Okay, we'll leave it all there. Thank you both this morning for helping us understand this better.
Thanks, Pia.
Adam Radwanski is a climate policy columnist for the Globe and Mail. Stephanie Taylor is the parliamentary reporter for the Canadian Press. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Happy Easter from all of us here at the Sunday Magazine. I want to remind you that if you miss any of our stories, you can find them all by streaming them at cbc.ca/Sunday. When Keith Meredith was 16 years old, he was driving with his girlfriend looking for a parking spot in Toronto when he was stopped by a police officer. And from that moment, Keith decided he too wanted to become a cop. It is exactly what happened. A 31-year career in law enforcement, most of it with York Regional Police, which is just north of Toronto. Keith did everything from patrol and undercover work to teaching combat skills and recruiting. He retired a superintendent in 2017. Well, now he is sharing his experience and views on police reform in a memoir. It is called A Darker Shade of Blue. Keith Meredith, good morning.
Good morning, Pia.
Let's pick up on the story that I just mentioned. When you're a teenager, you're with your girlfriend, you're driving, and a police officer pulls you over in Toronto. What happened in that parking lot?
I had just received my driver's license, so I was just a happy young guy. And my girlfriend and I decided we're going to go down to the Canadian National Exhibition just
the
to spend
fair.
A day.
Yeah,
you know, have a good time. So she had a vehicle. She let me drive. I thought that was wonderful. So I made my way down there, entered the parking lot. It was very, very full, and I was driving at a really slow pace, just trying to look for a spot. Came head-to-head with a police officer, Toronto police officer, that was, I suppose, monitoring the parking lots. And we made eye contact. As soon as we do that, the lights go on. He pulls me over, comes over to the car. First things out of his mouth is driver's license, ownership, and insurance, which I had prepared. I was ready to go. I handed it to him. And then this man just started to berate me. He called me all kinds of names. He mentioned my color more than once. He was just rude, and he was angry. So the bottom line was he didn't even check my papers. He just threw them back on my lap and left. Now, as a young man, 16 years of age, I was intimidated. I was humiliated. I was hurt. And I figured it out really quickly what the issue was. The issue was a young black man with a young white woman. That bothered him.
You learned that day that driving while black, as it's come to be known, is a real thing.
100% real thing. There was no reason other than my mahogany hue why this gentleman, I call him gentleman loosely, would have stopped me and treated me the way he did.
You're 16 years old, as you say. I'm excited. I just got my driver's license.
Yes.
I got this pretty girl,
yes.
My girlfriend. I'm going off to have a nice time with her. And then this happened. What do you recall about feeling in that moment? You said he was angry. How did you feel?
The word that came to mind immediately was emasculated. He took everything away from me. He did it in front of my girlfriend. I was powerless. And I felt that I had no recourse. I just had to take it. It took me a couple of days to sort it out in my mind and realize that this man had all the authority vested in him through his whiteness and the Toronto Police Service. I said to myself, you know what? I never want to be in that position again. And I made up my mind right there and then that I would join a police service.
So this is what's interesting to me, because this is not your story, telling that story. It's not an unfamiliar story to lots of black and brown men and some women in Canada, in the United States. We hear these stories all the time. And so many people in that situation, Keith, might decide, I want nothing to do with the police.
Yes,
I want nothing to do with law enforcement.
Yeah, uh-huh.
I want them to stay and do their thing, and it doesn't ever involve me. But you made like the opposite decision. Why?
It was in my mind as a young man, you know, just trying to grow and mature. I felt that in order for me to get that power and authority and use it properly, I need to be part of the system that grants that power and authority. And that's where I landed. You know, it took me a long time, but I joined the York Regional Police. And it was my second attempt at trying to get a job with them. I tell a story in the book about how long it took me to actually be hired by a police organization.
Because this isn't nowadays where there are diversity initiatives and so on and so forth in police departments and elsewhere. This was back in the day, so to speak.
This was really back in the day. That was 1986. And when I walked through the doors of York Regional Police, there was only one other black officer on the job at that time. So, you know, we're going back a few years.
Yeah, this is a large municipal police force.
It's huge, yes. Yeah.
And so you said it took you a while to even get the job.
So it took me 6 years and 13 police departments before I was finally hired by the York Regional Police.
And then the things that you were just talking about, I can do better and I want some authority to use that authority for good. And as I said in our introduction, that job lasts for you for 31 years.
Yes.
And you write about loving being a cop, but also not loving it. And you talk in the book about there were the overtly racist things that you have endured, but you also talk about the implicit racism, these microaggressions that you had to endure every day. These are the things that people, some people wouldn't call them racist. Other people say things like, oh, I didn't mean it that way, or maybe they did, I don't know. But things that you would people would say to you. Can you just, I know there's a range of examples, but can you give me a couple?
Absolutely. And some of them are almost innocuous, right? They didn't really mean what it actually flushed out to be. So a quick example is, you know, I like to dress sharply. I like to be nice and tight and clean. And my boots were immaculate. It wasn't strange to me for officers to remark about my shoes and if I would do their shoes as well, meaning that I'm now relegated to a shoeshine boy. You know, I would be at the station pumping gas into my vehicle. And of course, they're laughing and joking about me now being a service operator. I would go into a restaurant with some of the officers and they would make jokes in front of the staff. You know, they can serve me chicken and watermelon. It just kept going on that over and over and over. You know, those I call pinpricks, microaggressions.
I call them paper cuts. They add up over time.
They add up over time, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So these are your colleagues. These aren't strangers. These aren't people that you don't know.
Right.
These are your colleagues. What was the broader message you were receiving from them?
The message, absolutely, unequivocally, was they didn't like me as their equal, and they certainly didn't want me as their boss. And they made that known, both subtly and overtly.
And this was throughout your career. So it wasn't just like when you started, which was what you would have been in your early 20s. It was when you were in your 30s, 40s, 50s.
It was right through from day one till I walked out the door. So in the book, I outline what some of the things that have happened to me during the time period and at each level that I attained, how it flushed out differently. But the bottom line, it was the same.
You retired, I said, as a superintendent. That's high up.
It is, but I had to fight for that every step of the way. And the interesting thing about, you know, reaching to that position is that if I take my career and put it against another officer, a white officer that attained the same rank, it was almost like we're doing a different job. Well, it was, in fact, a two-tiered kind of system where they would get the support and the accreditations to move forward, where I had to fight like heck just to maintain. And I felt that I had to work three times as hard as they did just to attain the same levels that they were basically given.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm speaking with retired police superintendent Keith Merrith about his memoir. It is called A Darker Shade of Blue. Keith, you joined the police force in the early 80s. In those last number of decades, I don't have to tell you or our listeners, there have been awful incidents and images of police brutality that have been broadcast around the world, from Rodney King and even predating that to George Floyd and even past that. Those are just two prominent examples. There have been incidents, similar ones, in Canada as well. I don't just want to point out the American ones. You're a Black man who's a police officer. So when you see those, like, what's going through your mind? I understand the policing side. Like, I wouldn't be like that. That's not our teaching. That's not the protocol. Follow the rules. I understand that side. There is this human side as well for you.
There's a chapter in my book that we call Victim Kinship. And in that chapter, I explore the thought process that a lot of my friends that look like me, friends and family, how we process some of these incidences that have happened with our young Black men, young women that are assaulted or brutalized or killed by the police. There's a pain deep within us that we feel because we can relate. It could be a family member, brother, sister, aunt, uncle, cousin. And that's the kinship that I think is missing in a lot of the conversation. We feel it. It hurts. And it hurts deep within us. And me as an officer, having done the job, having been in a lot of situations that are similar, I understand the perspective that happens, but I cannot justify what these officers have done. It shouldn't have happened.
I named two American examples. I could probably rattle off another dozen on my hand. There have been incidents in Canada.
Yes, there has.
People see this oftentimes as a quote-unquote American problem and that the incidents that have happened in our country are outliers. How do you respond to that?
Well, that couldn't be further from the truth. There's a lot of things that happen each and every day to our diverse community, our racialized community, with police interaction that most of us don't hear about. But believe you me, it happens all the time. And every once in a while, there is a situation that is off the charts and it's reported and the news picks it up. But occurrences happen every day between police and our racialized community. For the most part, I will say that it's resolved, but there are a lot of residual pain and destruction that happens at the back end of that. So the truth is that we have a problem and we need to deal with it.
Problems require solutions. So let's 100%. Talk about those, yeah. Because you write about this. You've worked in so many different elements of policing, beat cop, undercover cop, narcotics, vice, use of force, training, community outreach, recruiting, and you come up with solutions, recommendations about how to improve policing. Let me just start on the individual accountability level. You write passionately about the duty of care of a police officer. What does that mean?
Well, it's a topic that is now at the forefront of policing, I believe. And that is the responsibility of each officer to monitor and control their fellow officers. If there's an incident where an officer is not behaving or conducting themselves in the way they should be doing it, there is a duty for the other officers on scene to stop that behavior.
I don't want to say but. There's a power dynamic, right? Maybe I've watched too many police procedurals, but there's usually a senior cop and a junior cop. So if I'm a junior person or any other person, I might not be like, I'm going to stand up to the guy who's more senior than me, maybe a bully, maybe a jerk face, all those things.
Yeah. And that's a reality that we have to face. But the situation is that if you are on scene, then you have to be responsible for that scene, no matter what the position is that you're in. And we have to start training our officers that way, because there's so many incidences that happen where an officer is not behaving the way they should be behaving. Other officers are on scene and they do nothing. That is not acceptable.
The silent enabler.
There is a duty and a responsibility if you're on scene to ensure that the outcomes are the way they should be, the way you can manage it, the best way you can manage it. And that includes the officer's behaviors, your partner's behaviors, other officers that are on scene. You have a duty of care.
Is that a challenge as you see it in training?
Yes, it is. It is. And all of the police training should involve a duty of care component to it, especially when we're talking about use of force. We do dynamic training, meaning that we try to emulate situations that happen on the streets as best we can while we're training. There should be a component to that training that deals with out-of-control officers, officers that are not acting in the way that they should be, and how to handle that. How do you intervene when it's your boss, right? But there's ways to do it, and there's a duty to do it. And I think that's the important part.
You talk about tangible, actionable things that can happen. A lot of what you talk about is this mindset shift that needs to happen, in particular, shifting this sort of overall collective and individual mindset from arresting to problem solving.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, during my days, the overall attitude was, let's go out and make some arrests. Well, no. You know, we are servants. That's what we do. Police is a situation, a career where we're serving the public. So I believe that the best way to do that is to problem solve. There are many occasions that we go in a situation where, yeah, we have the power to arrest, but is that the right thing to do at that time? Is there a better way to handle that situation?
Give me an example. It could be a theoretical
one.
Well,
I'll give you a quick example. I remember going to one of the large malls many, many years ago, and there was a screaming and a pushing incident between two girls. One, if I remember correctly, was 17, and the other one was a year older. They were not friends, but they crossed paths, and they didn't like each other, and they were pushing and yelling in the mall. And the security called the police. We arrived. When we flushed out what was going on, one of the girls uttered a threat. I'll kill you, you know? But it was two angry girls screaming at each other. Because she uttered those words, she was arrested. Here's a girl that has no criminal record, is going to school, has everything to look forward to in life. And now she has on her record an arrest.
And potentially a charge.
And potentially a charge, yeah. That situation, I felt, could have been handled quite differently. And we would have had a better result at the end of that.
Let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't you say anything in the moment?
That's a great question. Understand the dynamics in the police service at that time. So
that's why I wanted to ask you this question.
Oh, yeah. As a young officer, you know, you kind of rely on the senior officers to make those decisions, right? So it wasn't that it was wrong because there was a charge there. There was an arrestable offense. But now, you know, in my maturity in terms of policing, was that the best thing to do at that time? Well, I don't think it was, right?
There are lots of people from within racialized communities and beyond who say, this is irreparable. And the amount of calls to defund the police, there's a lot to that. It's not just defund the police, but I want to get your thoughts on that. When people say, can't fix this institution, man, doesn't matter. Guys like Keith Merritt are yelling from the rafters. They're saying, here's some solutions. It doesn't change. Let's defund this.
Well, I'm not sure what defunding actually means. I mean, looking at the police service from the inside and the idea around policing, it's actually a good thing. It does work. But you have individuals and to a point you have a system that keeps going sideways. So I think the better idea is to address those issues head on, be honest, be fair, be transparent, and fix the problems. Now, it's people, right? That's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with individuals. So let's focus on them. The institution will be what it is, but it will be better if the people that are running those institutions are better. So in my mind, that's where we need to focus. And we can do it. We can do it. You know, I always talk about the diversity, the hiring, and, you know, getting the best people on the job because they are your future. But how do we guarantee that these folks that you're hiring are the best representatives on your police service? So I talk about how do we mold these individuals. One of the things I talk about is having the best coach officers that you could possibly get in your organization.
Mentors, because, essentially.
Absolutely, because they are the ones. So the young people, the new recruits are sponges. They will absorb whatever you give them. So give them the best. Give them the best that you can through your organization. And I guarantee you there will be a change in their attitudes, in their behavior, in how they do their job and how they process. I guarantee you that will happen. That's one of the things.
Your book is new into this world, but these issues are not new to you, and you have spoken out about them for a long time. Your memoir is pretty no holds barred, really, in your critique of racism in law enforcement. Some of your former colleagues, some police officers who read this, will be very unhappy with what you say. What do you hope they take away from it?
Well, the essence of the book, it's a memoir, but the essence in terms of the policing part of it is I hope that they will walk with me through this book and apply their experiences with what I experienced. And I'm hoping that there will be a reality check for many of these officers that were, what I would say, the problem. And I just hope that upon reflection, upon reading the book and walking through a lot of the scenarios with me, that there's a change of heart. And really, it starts with the heart. If you can reach them at that level, you can have a change. And once you've changed somebody or influenced them or impacted them, they will do the same for other people. So it's one of those domino effects. And that's what I'm hoping for a lot of the officers, not only the folks that I work with, but the police services right across the GTA, right across Canada, right across North America, that I'm telling you what happened and I'm telling you how I felt. I'm not, you know, relating stories that happened 1,000 years ago to somebody else. I'm telling you my story, my reality. Listen to me, hear me. And hopefully you will work with me and the rest of the community to effect some changes.
It's a long career. And as you said, just trying to make it better.
Yes, absolutely.
I appreciate you coming in and I appreciate talking to you and listening to you today. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Keith Meredith is a retired superintendent from the York Regional Police, which is just north of Toronto. He had a 31-year career in policing. His new memoir is out, and it is called A Darker Shade of Blue.
I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back in 1949, a dozen Western countries, including our own, joined together in a military alliance called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO will mark its 75th anniversary this week, with foreign affairs ministers in the alliance gathering at its headquarters in Brussels. For three quarters of a century, NATO has promised collective defense of its member nations, defense that has a new resonance today against the backdrop of multiple conflicts around the globe. Joel Sokolsky is a professor of political science at Royal Military College of Canada in Kingston, Ontario. He is also the author of a number of books, including Canada in NATO 1949 to 2019. Joel, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Most people cannot remember a time without NATO, but let's go back. What was going on in the world post-World War II that led the United States, Canada, and 10 other countries to form this alliance?
Well, the European allies became concerned that their security was in danger by the Soviet Union. They approached Canada. Canada and the Europeans approached the United States to create a collective defense organization that would exist alongside the UN. So Canada was not just an original member of NATO. It was one of nations which was responsible for its creation.
Hmm. And then if we fast forward to after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, there were calls at that time for NATO to be disbanded. And yet now, some three decades after that, NATO has more members than it ever has, 32. What happened?
Well, there was concern that about future stability in Europe. There was some concern about whether you would have a resurgence of a threat from Russia. And there was an effort to keep the Europeans united in a collective defense arrangement, and NATO had already existed. There was also petitions from former Warsaw Pact members and from former Soviet republics to join this alliance. They were concerned about the future facing perhaps a resurgent Russia.
Hmm. As you say, Canada was critical to the formation of NATO and continues, of course, to be a big part of it. However, there has been hand-wringing debate and defense about our country's commitments to NATO. We'll get into that 2% of GDP that I mentioned in just a little bit. But I want to ask you this, Joel. The U.S. ambassador to NATO, Julianne Smith, recently called on Canada to develop a, quote, concrete plan to meet its spending targets. There was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal which described our country as a military-free rider in the alliance. How would you characterize our defense strategy over the year? Are those criticisms fair?
Well, it's correct. We are not meeting the 2%. And except for the early 1950s, when we were making a significant contribution, the Canadian contribution has always drawn a certain amount of criticism from the allies in terms of spending. But in fact, if you look back over the alliance, and particularly in the post-Cold War era, Canada has been an active contributor in Yugoslavia, and certainly in Afghanistan, in Libya, now in Latvia. We contributed to the training of the Ukrainian forces. So it's not just the amount you spend, it's what you do. And as far as what you do for the alliance, Canada has been fairly active. And our allies, including the United States, have always wanted more Canada. They've wanted more spending, but they've also looked for contributions from the highly professional Canadian Armed Forces.
Hmm. You have referred to our contributions and our country's role in NATO as having a Walmart approach rather than a Saks Fifth Avenue approach when it comes to defense. What do you mean by that?
That although Canada has been active, it's been wishes to restrain the amount of government funding it spends on defense. And this has been the case for a number of decades. That being said, Canada is the 14th largest military spender in the world, but it ranks in about 93% in the percentage of GDP for defense. So Canada's tried to do as much as it can within NATO, but has fiscally constrained the defense budget. And all governments have done this.
Hmm. So let's zone in to that 2%. This is the 2% of GDP on defense that the many countries call on Canada to meet to ensure NATO military readiness. Pardon me. Where did this benchmark even come from? How significant is it? We always talk about it, but it's kind of like it's a target. It's this. What is the meaning of all this 2%?
Well, this is a figure agreed upon by the allies. And it's more of a political figure than it is concrete. I mean, you can spend 2% on GDP by simply spending on personnel and not spending on equipment. Or you can reduce what you spend on services for the military and increase equipment. And there is no consistency in what countries include in defense spending. Hmm. Some people include their internal security. Some people include their coast guards. And so it's an arbitrary figure. However, for a G7 country to spend less than 2% on defense, this is what is catching the notice of our allies. And they know that Canada could spend more, but chooses not to.
Yeah, in Canada, for example, as you say, some things are encompassed that other countries don't. Our Canadian Coast Guard, our veterans' pensions were recently included in the country's calculation of military spending. So if GDP spending is not the best way, perhaps, to measure military contributions, what might be?
Well, the number of forces you contribute, if you look, for example, back to the 90s, we had a significant contribution in Yugoslavia. I don't have to say that we had a very significant contribution and took losses in Afghanistan when other allies were not willing to undertake combat roles. We were involved in the Libyan operations. We have deployed now forward-based forces in Latvia. And one thing about Canada is, unlike other allies except the United States, we have to deploy overseas. And that's an added expense. So if you measure where we contribute, we are there. We do have highly professional forces, but we're just we're not willing to spend what the allies think we should be spending. We also take a long time to acquire equipment, which is also a problem.
I know it's important for you to recognize, as you just have done, all that Canada has done, all the ways we have shown up. And there isn't exactly a penalty for not meeting that 2% target, but to what extent do you think we need to be nervous, worried, concerned about our reputation on the world stage taking a hit?
I don't think we need to be overly concerned about that. There's no evidence that if we increase defense spending to the 2% level, Canada is going to have any greater influence on what our allies do in terms of their strategy. I think we should do it because it's the right thing to do, because NATO is something that's in our interest. Keeping the allies united in the face of these threats is certainly in Canada's interest. And if we can do it, we should be spending more. We shouldn't be worried about what our allies think. We should be worried about doing what's right.
Joel, appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joel Sokolsky is a political science professor at the Royal Military College of Canada. This is the Sunday Magazine. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and we're talking right now about Canada's role in NATO as the alliance will mark its 75th anniversary this week. I want to bring in Richard Shimuka, senior fellow at the Macdonald Laurier Institute. He writes on defense policy. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let's start where I left off with Joel Sokolsky, which is sort of, is Canada's reputation taking a hit given it's not meeting this 2% target? What's your view?
It's certainly taking a hit. You're seeing it both within NATO itself and specifically within the United States as well. I think you cited the Wall Street Journal article. You see The Economist, and you're seeing a series of pretty influential senators within the United States basically identify Canada as a laggard and sort of put us on notice that we should spend. And even the NATO the head of NATO basically has kind of alluded to the lack of spending. So you're starting to see a growing chorus of individuals outside of Canada identify our lack of spending as a serious issue to them.
And is your assessment that criticism is fair?
Yeah, I think it is. Certainly, the 2% guideline is a guideline, and as Professor Sokolsky mentioned, it's uneven in how it's identified or how it's calculated and what is spent upon. But I think that it's a rough measure that allows you to understand how much a state is spending. And if you start peering into the details of how Canada spends that money, where's it going, the sort of the military capability that we get out of it, you start to see some serious issues. It's for allies, they don't just look at the 2%. They'll look at what are you providing and how the sort of military capability that you're putting out there, and then they'll make the assessment, and I think that's kind of informing their view.
I'm glad you brought up the status and state of our military. An internal Department of Defense document obtained by CBC News showed that almost half of CAFs, that's Canadian Armed Forces equipment, is considered unavailable and or unserviceable. Practically speaking, then, what does that mean and look like for our military missions?
So if you think about the defense budget, there's three components. As I said, there's personnel, there's the operation and maintenance side, which is the fuel, the spare parts, and all that takes to operate the military. And then you have the capital, the buying the equipment and all that. And we've really underinvested in capital over the past 20 or 30 years. There's actually a new guideline for that. It says around 20%. We basically hit 10 to 15. And a lot of serious major powers will actually go up to 30%. So what's happened is that you have a lot of equipment that's really gone to the end of its life lifespan. Usually we have to call rust out. It's about 20 or 30 years, depending on what system it is. And a lot of the Canadian Forces equipment is actually 30 years plus, right? We're looking at CF-18s that are hitting 40 years now. So as a result, you're really seeing equipment that takes a lot longer to maintain, to repair, to get into service effectively. If you think about our frigates, they used to take about 200,000 man hours to repair through docking repair and all that. Now they're hitting 1.25, maybe even 1.5 million hours to get ready to operate. So a lot of the equipment now has sort of gone to the age where there isn't enough. It takes too long to repair, to get it in service and operating. You're seeing the maintenance on it, or the sort of availability, decline to the point where they aren't ready to operate in that. There's a very related problem that we actually don't have enough people to operate that equipment. That's also affecting the availability of these systems.
We'll talk about that in just a sec. But let's say, for example, we do get our defense spending up to 2% that we've been talking about. Would that money be enough to tackle, you know, the equipment problems, the issues that you've just outlined?
No, because we've actually underinvested for so long. We have what's called a bow wave, that we have a series of large deferred equipment purchases that need to happen to get us back to much more a fleet age that's much younger, that doesn't require as much work. And so that deferred equipment spending is basically beyond what would push us significantly beyond that 2% that the guidelines when it really comes down to the actual cash purchases.
Okay, let's talk about the people. Federal Defense Minister Bill Blair called recruitment for the Canadian Armed Forces, quote, a death spiral. At the same time, we continue to hear about this need to reform the culture within the military, the toxic culture that many people have pointed out. What do you see as that relationship between culture, funding, and investment? Is there a sort of a through line?
There is, but I don't think it's necessarily the one that a lot of people think of. Certainly, there is an issue with toxic culture, with sexualized violence that's occurred, that's been highlighted. But I think for most Canadian Forces members, the issues that they face are much more related to their day-to-day and personal concerns. So you see, as Professor Scolsi talked about earlier, just Canada has been a very active contributor, and we've sort of spent a lot on operations maintenance because we're out there a lot, right? We're in, you know, like Syria or Latvia. And so what's happened is that deployment, the high tempo, has basically really affected the personal lives of a lot of forces. And with the lack of equipment coming through because of, you know, underinvestment there, a lot of them start to, you see the morales have started to sag over the past decade. Is that we've been over deployed. People aren't coming in as well. There's a morale problem that's kind of seeped into the forces, and you start to see people relieve because they say, well, I don't think I'm going to be able, I don't see any replacements coming in. I'm kind of getting tired of this. I'm going to leave. And then there's also pay concerns and all that. When this has kind of come all together, you're starting to see the retention tick higher than the actual recruitment side. And that death spiral is that fewer people are required to take the same amount of role. And as over time, they're not being replaced, more people leave, and the cycle just gets worse and worse and worse. And that's really affected. So you're seeing, for a lot of individuals, I think the more broader concern is, you know, being moved across the country, over deployment and pay issues that really affect their day-to-day lives. Mm.
The federal budget is going to be delivered in just a little over 2 weeks. There are, of course, myriad pressing concerns for Canadians, many different groups and issues and policies needing federal dollars, housing, healthcare, cost of living, the list kind of goes on. So how would you convince someone that we also need to prioritize defense? What's the case?
I think there's a myriad of ways you can make that argument. The first one I think Professor Skolsky identified earlier was that it is something that we need to do. That our allies, you know, we are seen as a member of a community of like-minded states, that we should do our part there. I think there's a much more hard-edged view that you can take, and it specifically relates to the United States, is that we have a very, very close relationship with the United States in our security and defense. We have a joint command, NORAD, where we basically operate as a binational command, I should say, that together as a single whole. And the Americans see, like, they watch, right? And they see our debates, and they pay for part of our defense through NORAD as well. So I think that if you look at senators, you look at Dan Sullivan from Alaska and others who have identified Canada as not really meeting its commitments, they see that. And when they look at issues such as softwood lumber or trade issues or environmental issues, they're very transactional in their approach to looking at, you know, politics. And they say, well, if you're not spending here and you're not spending our defense, well, I'm not going to be helpful in other areas. And I think that's a persistent concern that you know, many Canadian governments need to see, and the Canadian public should really understand. And on a much less acute level, you see it with our allies. It's not nearly as apparent as our relationship with the United States, where they do care about the security. They do care about the defense of the North. So I would say that's probably one of the most clearest arguments. Like, if we do not spend, countries will notice, and they'll be less likely to sort of help us out on other issues that we care about that are related to our economy or, you know, our personal well-being in other ways.
So this week in Brussels, as foreign affairs ministers gather at NATO headquarters, it's going to be a lot of reflection and marking the 75th and also talking about very present day issues. There's two new member countries in Finland and Sweden. It's all happening, of course, against the backdrop of war in Ukraine. How is the Defense Alliance, how is NATO repositioning its priorities and values in this new era of global instability?
Certainly, I think Ukraine has kind of focused the mind, if you could say, of all the member countries. You look at, to use the 2% debate, you see the Czech Republic has basically put into law that it's going to meet its 2% guidelines. You see the German defense mission suggests that they may go to 3.5% of GDP, when this is a country that used to sit around 1.2% of GDP. So a lot of countries are taking this very seriously. And I think there's the related issue of potential Donald Trump re-election in the United States has also made Europeans even more serious about ensuring that they have their own house in order, so to speak, to deal with the threat of Russia. There's a lot of concern that if we aren't seen as being serious about security, if we don't actually provide forces and real military capability that can defend ourselves, then what's the point? We can't just completely rely on the United States that it happened, you know, since the origins of NATO. If we can't even defend ourselves, then we have a serious or this is we're not being serious about our own responsibilities to our state or to our region. And I think that that's become very much so for. There's also a related understanding that technology is changing rapidly and that we need reform, or NATO needs reform to sort of identify the innovative new technologies that are sort of affecting our day-to-day lives, not to mention, you know, the militaries themselves. And you're seeing real effort to sort of devise innovation structures that are able to identify new technologies and get them into militaries and incorporate them collectively together. Because with NATO, many countries are very small, right? And in order to, if they are able to integrate effectively into a cohesive whole, that really increases the potential power. And in some ways allows other countries to decrease spending or not spending as much in order to provide for their own defense.
Appreciate your time and assessment as well this morning. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you very much.
Richard Shimuka is a senior fellow at the Macdonald Laurier Institute. This is The Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio, Sirius XM 169, as well as on the CBC Listen app. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Ala Gurani's feats in journalism have been many over the past three decades. You might have seen her anchor her own namesake show on CNN International or watched her in the field reporting amid countless conflicts in the Middle East and beyond, or interviewing world leaders, people including Tony Blair and Shimon Peres, the Dalai Lama. But alongside her career, Hala's been on a quest that is common to many people, trying to understand her identity and what it means to belong as a person whose life and work span the globe. Hala delves into that journey in a new memoir. It is called But You Don't Look Arab. Hala Gurani, hi.
Hi, Pia.
You have such a giant life story that is shaped by various cultures and countries. So just to kind of lay it out for our listeners, you are a kid of Syrian and French parents who moved to the U.S. where you were born. And then you moved to France with your mom after your folks got divorced. And then you spent much of your upbringing there. So given the number of places and backgrounds and influences, how did that big context sort of shape your understanding of who you were growing up? Because it's hard being a kid growing up at the best of times.
It really is. And it wasn't just that my parents were Syrian, that I was raised in France, born in the U.S., and then lived for many years in London. It was also that I came from, even within my own family, from generations of displacement. I talk in the book about how when the Ottoman Empire finally completely collapsed, the Arab members of my family who were living in Istanbul had to go back to their ancestral home in Aleppo. And generation after generation, this is kind of a universal story, really. It's not just an Arab and a Middle Eastern story. People have to be on the move all the time. It's a great privilege, people don't realize, in Western countries, to have ancestors over many generations in the country where you live. I didn't have, you know, sort of like church registry weddings that I could consult when I did my research. Everything is scattered all around the world because people look for economic opportunity. They flee wars and revolutions and natural disasters. And here I am, the product of all of that.
So this kind of brings us to the title of your book, which is But You Don't Look Arab. So I have to say, when I moved to the Middle East in 2006, you know, I knew there would be a diversity of people and people would look different. But every time I met a bright blue-eyed blonde Egyptian or a redheaded Palestinian or a very dark Israeli, it always reminded me that there was so much diversity in a part of the world that I think a lot of people think people look all the same. And so can you just describe for people who may never have laid eyes on you what you look like and how often you sort of heard that line that your title of the book is from, which is, but you don't look Arab, and what how that sort of landed for you?
So for people who don't know what I look like, I look a lot like Claudia Schiffer. No, I'm just
You do, a little bit. There's a resemblance.
With radio, I can just say that. No, I think the reason I decided to go with that title is because, look, I want to confront stereotypes. I mean, fundamentally, it's what we kids of immigrant parents try to do our entire lives. You know, oh, you're Arab? Oh, you're Muslim? Oh, you must be fasting or you must pray five times a day. Why don't you wear a hijab? Why don't you this? Why don't you that? As if you are, as the kid of an immigrant, the representative, the ambassador, and the spokesperson for a billion people. And that can be exhausting. And I know that kids and what so-called third culture kids can be exhausted by that, because as a child, you want nothing more than to fit in. And you don't fit in when your name is Hala. And my dad's name was Basha. So my name in France when I grew up was Hala Basha. People don't pronounce the H, so I became Allah. Every joke in the book about Allah, was hurled at me as a kid. And I just got tired of it. So that title just illustrates the fact that we are diverse. Every population, subculture is diverse. And here I am, a blonde, blue-eyed Arab with Syrian parents, and we exist. You know, I think that's why I went for it.
There's a kid listening to us. More adults and kids, let's be fair, that listen to our program. But there is a kid listening to us who's saying to themselves, well, I get that all the time. I get, you don't look, you know, fill in the blank here.
Yeah.
What do you say to them?
I'm not going to lie. It's not easy. When you're that age, you want to be like everyone else and you want to look like everyone else. When I grew up in France, you know, I talk about in the book about how I didn't have like that genetic French skinniness, and I didn't look like those, you know, French girls with named after fruit like Clementine and prune and stuff. I desired nothing more than to be like them. And I would say to that kid, of course, the advice we would give any child is embrace your difference. It's great to not be like everyone else, but this is something that you only appreciate in adulthood. And I think there is a wound that kind of, there's a bit of an injury, kind of a psychological injury as a child that heals in adulthood and gives you strength. But in childhood, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to navigate. I think the one thing I would tell parents rather than the child is if you come from a different culture, and there are so many cases like this in Canada, it would be good not to move the kid around too much. I always change schools every 2 or 3 years, and that wasn't ideal. So I think if the kid is given a really firm foundation, that would certainly help a lot.
Okay, so let's talk about that sort of injury, because injuries, as you say, heal, and they often help sort of guide us in what we want to do in life. We might not realize it, but they kind of do. So those questions of identity that were swirling around for you and your family history, how did they really inform your choice to pursue journalism?
I think they were a huge part in it, because I've always loved the idea of researching my family background. It's a very rich and unusual and exotic story, you know, all through the Ottoman Empire and then via Aleppo, Baghdad, Bulgaria, Abkhazia, you name it. But also this moving around a lot, this speaking several languages. And in Middle Eastern households, this is also something that really is, I think, important to underline when it came to my career choice. People talk about the news all the time. Because the Middle East was in the news and still is in the news, you would hear talk of current events, you would know who the presidents of countries were, you would have a basic understanding of geography, even as a child. So I think that as an adult, then, when I was choosing a career, it made a lot of sense to go into that. So the two things, loving the you know, research, documentation, and also being interested in current affairs, those two things came together, and so it became an obvious career choice.
Hmm. Okay, so then you go to this prestigious Paris University, and you got to get a job, right? You come out of school, you're trying to get a job. And again, who you are and your background and your identity plays into your luck, good luck, bad luck. Let's talk about when you start applying for jobs. You weren't having much luck. So what do you chalk that up to?
Well, I mean, just anecdotally, I didn't have a photo on my resume. I mentioned that I spoke Arabic. My name was very Arab sounding, and I wasn't getting any callbacks. And some of my friends who'd graduated at the same time as me from Sciences Po in Paris were getting a lot more, you know, were getting more interviews. And one of my friends said to me, you know, I would just remove the fact that you speak Arabic, because they're going to think that, you know, you're North African Arab. You know, it's sad, right? But I did it because I was so desperate to work in journalism that in a way you kind of whitewash yourself to fit in. And it worked. I got more interviews. But despite it all, I had to leave France because I just didn't feel like I hadn't done the right school. I didn't have the right profile. And so, you know, I joined Bloomberg and then a few years later CNN, where I felt like there was more opportunity for me there.
Yeah. You didn't just, you know, do the photo. You took off that you spoke Arabic and you changed your name.
Yeah. I changed my name from my dad's name, Basha, to Gorani, my mom's name. And Gorani, and they're both Syrian, but Gorani just sounded more generically European.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just sounded, in French, it became, instead of Ala Basha, it became A la Gorani, and then that sounds, I don't know, Balkan, Italian, something like that. And it was, I got fewer questions as well.
Yeah, I can't, I mean, these aren't historical sort of stories. I can't tell you the number of times people have asked me why I didn't change my name, that I should change my name, or that I should pronounce my name the way it's pronounced in Bengali, which is my parents' language, which is Chattopadhyay. And I always say, chances if I said Pia Chattopadhyay on the air, people wouldn't hear what I was reporting on, or would say, well, what is that? You know, so names are a funny thing in that way, that they people take them as an access point.
Yeah. But also, you don't say, you know, you don't pronounce country names and city names in the way that natives pronounce them. I mean, you have to adapt the name, your name, my name, to the language and to the culture. Otherwise, it just becomes you put yourself out of reach in a different way by not somehow adapting the pronunciation to the local language.
Yeah, you know? And that's changing. I see younger journalists and other people, you know, really sticking to, but we grew up in a slightly different time, and so we adapted and all those things. But it is a strange balancing act, isn't it, Hala? Like, on the one hand, in your case, you know, people can misread you, perhaps even be skeptical of you. But on the other hand, you also have this privilege of passing as white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have, the privilege goes both ways. So I can also, when I'm in the Middle East, speak Arabic and integrate. And when I'm in a Western country, I look and sound completely Western. It's when that first kind of introduction is made, and the name is, and I introduce myself with my name, that the questions start. But otherwise, I do have the privilege. For instance, I can tell you, my brother looks very Middle Eastern. Let's just say he gets a lot more questions at the airport than I do. Clearly, I can blend in a lot more easily than someone who more obviously looks Middle Eastern or Arab. But again, I think in my job, it's great because I could go report at a funeral in the West Bank and speak Arabic with the people there. And then a few weeks later, go cover a Trump rally, and no one in either place will question my presence there because of the way I look. So that's a huge privilege as a journalist.
Yeah, you can code switch all the time, right?
All the time, yeah.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Hala Gurani, the journalist, about identity and belonging and her career as an anchor and correspondent over the past 3 decades. She has a new memoir out. It's called But You Don't Look Arab. Okay, so Hala, once you sort of break through in journalism, then things really take off for you. You become an anchor for Bloomberg, as you mentioned, in London, then for CNN International. When did you first really say, like, look, I've got a big asset here. I have this knowledge. I have this understanding of Arab culture. I am of that heritage. When did you finally start to leverage your knowledge of Arab culture and language and the Middle East in your work?
I think after 9/11, really, when it became obvious that, and in the lead up to the Iraq war, but it wasn't that easy. You know, I mean, I was a woman in my 20s and I wasn't being necessarily given those assignments. I mean, I was asked to anchor a design show for a year, you know. But then after the Iraq war really started in earnest and it became a very dangerous place to report from, if you were volunteering for those assignments, you were being sent. That's when I think it really started working in my favor, this notion that I could understand the culture, speak the language, and then really that's something you wanted to add to your resume at that point, not remove from your resume. Then there was the Israel-Hezbollah war that I covered, and that was a really pivotal moment in my career because I felt like that was the one war that I covered from beginning to end and from the inside, from a culture I knew, the Levant, and a city that I knew pre-war, pre that war, obviously, because it was post to the Civil War. It was, I think it was around that time that I started really feeling like my background and my language skills were a huge plus.
That was 2006, and it was when I landed in the Middle East to be a correspondent over there. And I know I told you this before we started, but seeing you on television, I could see a little bit of maybe what I aspired to or who I could be. So thank you for that. I really appreciate having seen you because I felt like I was seen.
Thank you.
And we were talking before we started about Christiane Amanpour, who you write about as well. Trailblazer for, I think, every female journalist, especially war correspondents and reporters out in the field. And you write, quote, her qualities are usually those lauded in men but scorned in women. What do you mean by that?
I hope she'll like that I'm saying this about her. She doesn't really ask, you know, she says, I'm doing this. And this is something that I think when women are assertive in that way, they're labeled as difficult and as bitchy or as rude or as egomaniacs. And I think oftentimes, and we've heard this before, when men behave in similar ways, they're simply, you know, go-getters and assertive. And I always admired her for that. And she's still that way. I mean, she's of another generation. She's older than we are. But she's still, you know, out there doing incredible work. And that's what I meant when I wrote that. You know, she's just somebody who is extremely confident in a way that gets her the assignments and the respect, not just of viewers, but, you know, of management and the bosses. And I think that's one of the hardest things for women to do. And it is to say, I want this or I don't want that. That's also something I think that's very difficult for women to do, is to say, I know this assignment you're telling me I should be doing, I don't want to do it.
And so how did that change how you approach your career once you started thinking about, like, look, I want to be like Amanpour, poor, at least in the approach and the confidence and all those things?
Mm-hmm. I think I learned early on that when you want something, you need to come to managers and bosses with a plan, with a budget. You can't just sit kind of back and expect people to come to you with the assignments. And that's something as well that somebody like Christiane, but many, many others, I mean, Clarissa Ward, who's a great friend, they are go-getters. They are people with plans. They have strategies to cover stories. They figure out ways to get access. This is early on what I tried to do in my career. I don't expect someone to come to me and offer me the perfect assignment. I have to come up with it myself. And I have to come up with the budget and the access and a security plan and everything else. So I think that's probably how observing people like Christiane and other amazing female correspondents like Lise Doucette, who's Canadian, by the way.
Yes, yes.
And others, and Lindsay Hilsum, and all of these fantastic women who are icons and who have been my inspiration for many years. When I look at how they do journalism, they do it proactively. There's no waiting for something to be offered to them or waiting for inspiration.
And one of the things when you start covering various stories in the Middle East is that it seems like a no-brainer. Like the fact that you know the culture, that you speak the language, that you're familiar with some of these places would just be such an asset. But you also talk about getting pushback.
Well, you do have, I mean, on some stories, on the Syria story, on the Israel-Gaza story, there you have such entrenched camps. You might get some attacks from one side or the other because on any given day you're doing a story about, you know, one topic versus another. So that sometimes happens. But by and large, I have to say, it has not been a difficult experience for me over the last several decades of working in the Middle East. If anything, I get a lot of, oh, we're so proud of you. Mm-hmm. By the way, I take that for granted, that we're so proud of you, because this is a region that in the grand arc of history is going through a very tough time right now. The last, I don't know, 100 years or so, or 70 years or so of the Middle East. So when you represent in the minds of people from that part of the world, achievement on some level, and you get the "we're so proud of you," it just warms my heart. I just feel like I have all these aunties and uncles who are just like watching me and saying, "Oh, look, she's from where we come from, and she's done well, and she's represented us well." So that's always fabulous to hear.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm sure you hear that as well.
I do. I was smiling when you said that. And there's, you know, I have a million stories of going to drop off my dry cleaning and the guy that works there is South Asian and says, "My 12-year-old kid, she saw you or she heard you." And like, it's amazing. It's the best gift.
Isn't it? Especially when you hear it, when you hear parents say that their kids are inspired by you. That is absolutely fabulous.
Best feeling.
Let's talk about Syria, because as you say, it's been a difficult time in history for Syria. And the last 13 years, this year, this month marks 13 years since the civil war started. And I'm wondering how you're reflecting on that more broadly when you look at Syria today and, you know, the hope of the so-called Arab Spring and the humanitarian crisis, the war that we see there now, as someone of Syrian heritage, as a journalist who has covered it. And how are you just thinking about it 13 years later?
Yeah, I think that it is the one story that still saddens me almost with the same intensity now as it did 13 years ago, because I always describe Syria. I never lived there. I wasn't born there, but it was almost as if Syria was a member of my family and as if that family member died, you know, or was very, very ill. So I don't go back to Syria now. I don't think it would be necessarily a good idea, but it's something that still absolutely makes me emotional and sad, and I don't know that I'll ever get over it more than any other story, because when you're from somewhere, of course, you know the streets, you know the landmarks, the Mamluk era hammam, the Ottoman hotel, the citadel in Aleppo, the souk, the whatever, all these places that have been destroyed. It's like every time it was like being stabbed in the heart. It was horrible. And now I can kind of look back and smile at some of the memories, but it's still very, very painful.
You know, you started at the beginning of our conversation talking about your family's history of displacement. And of course, you have been reporting on conflicts, the war in Ukraine, the Israel-Hamas war. Those themes of displacement and statelessness come up time and time again. So I'm just wondering, as you're covering those stories and thinking about displacement and your own story, what are you thinking about the idea of displacement nowadays?
Well, now with globalization and so many kids straddling two or three cultures, it's becoming more and more common, I think, for children to be the children of globalization and displacement and migration. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that it's sometimes a little bit confusing when, for instance, in my case, I was moved around a lot. But I think ultimately it is a source of enrichment. And it depends entirely on how I think also the child is told, how that displacement is explained to them. I think I wrote this book in some ways to make peace with this notion that I am the product of these generations of displacement and migration and uprooting. And I came to a conclusion that, you know, I think my home is in the journey, in a sense, that I found my home in this constant movement that has just defined my life. Would I have preferred more stability? Maybe ultimately it would have made me maybe a less anxious, less kind of a little bit less on the move, but I would have not had as rich a life as I have led. So that's kind of where I think where I landed on that question.
And on the more philosophical question, Hala, of belonging, because you have written the book, it's out in the world, you've had a bit of time to reflect.
Yeah.
On the bigger philosophical meaning of belonging, how's that sitting with you?
It's a question that I'm still grappling with. Where do I belong? What culture do I belong in? I'm not a member of any tribe. You know, I write in the book that people who feel at home everywhere and nowhere belong to tribes of one. And it's lonely to be in a tribe of one. You know, I think I understand why people embrace religious communities or expat communities, because that's where you belong. But I've never really been able to find a home in any one group. And I don't think that will ever change, because if at 54, I'm still kind of feeling a little stateless in terms of what group I need to integrate or where I belong, I don't think that's going to change in the years that I have left. So I've come to the conclusion that I'm still just going to be roaming and observing and doing my job as a journalist and writing about other people and hoping that I can see myself reflected in the people I cover. I mean, I write in the book that every time I interview someone who looks out of place, I ask them all these questions because I want to find some of me in them. They don't realize it, but that's really what I'm doing.
There's so many people that are trying to find themselves and where they belong and maybe not coming up with an obvious answer, but there's so many people in the same situation. And I think your story will help them see themselves. So thank you for it.
Thank you so much. I hope it's at least one piece of the puzzle for somebody.
Thanks, Hala.
Thank you.
Hala Gurani is a longtime anchor and correspondent. She currently works for MSNBC and NBC News. Her memoir is called But You Don't Look Arab. That's it for this week on the Sunday Magazine. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Adam Killick, Pete Mitten, and Aronde Williams. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.